Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. You know, every now and then we like to have on as guests of American Variety authors who are just starting out as novelists, who are published and show promise of making a career of it. And it's tough today, probably tougher than it was in the past, and it's always been a hard thing to pursue. But my guest today is a woman who lives in Western North Carolina and has published two novels in short succession in August of last year and in February of this year. They follow the story of multiple generations of a family in the Blue Ridge Mountains from the beginning of the 20th century into the mid-1950s. And the writing I found is fresh and vivid, and the characters are really authentic people, not hillbilly caricatures, but a wide variety of well-rounded and interesting people. The genre is something she calls women's fiction, and we're going to talk about that too. The author is Janie DeVoe. Welcome, Janie.
Thank you, Court. Thank you for having me on.
Nice to have you on. So we're talking here about two novels. And the first is called Beneath a Thousand Apple Trees, and the second one is The Art of Breathing. So, Janie, why don't you just start in by giving us the outline of the stories? And I know it's two books, so it'll take a little while, and I may ask a few questions, but, you know, where and when do they take place, and who are the people you're writing about?
Well, the first book, Beneath a Thousand Apple Trees, it starts in the late 1880s in Appalachian Mountains, and it is a multi-generational saga of a family named the Gwynns and the Holtons. It's really based around three generations of women, grandmother, mother, and daughter. It follows their lives and their hardships through the Appalachian Mountains from the 1880s up to about the 1930s. It's very much about their relationships and the fractures in them, and just really watching the protagonist, who is the daughter, Rachel, growing and developing her own relationships with her mother and her grandmother. Then the sequel to that is The Art of Breathing, and this also follows the Gwynn family, one of the characters from Beneath a Thousand Apple Trees, and she contracts tuberculosis. Now we're up into the 1950s, and it's her journey with this disease and being institutionalized with it. It was an interesting kind of period to write about because many of the tuberculosis cases were being treated and treated at home where people could live normal lives. But there were some mitigating factors, if you will, with my character and her health and why she had to be institutionalized. It was really very interesting researching this and developing that story. And that goes up until the mid-1950s.
Yeah, so the two novels really are connected pretty much, you know, head to toe. How many generations are covered, Janie? I mean, I read both books, and I could count them up, I guess, but I lost track. But you know better than I do. It's like several, you know?
Yes, there are four altogether. Three in the first, and then there's another generation added in the sequel, The Art of Breathing. That was an interesting character to write as well.
And does that count the little son of the woman who ends up in the tuberculosis sanitarium?
Yes, it does. Okay. Yes, it does.
Yeah, so some of it's, you know, pretty dramatic. And you know, we'll talk about this later. It's not a classic romance novel, you know, where you've got the swashbuckling, tall, dark, and handsome hero who conquers the the woman. It's not like that. It's more like real life, really. I mean, it is very realistic, real life, naturalistic kind of writing. But there is romance in it, but in a normal way, and it's very, some of it's pretty gritty. I mean, you know, some right. crimes are committed and that kind of thing, so interesting.
Right.
But I don't think you're a native North Carolinian, right?
No, I'm not. And although I've been vacationing here since I was just a wee one, then my husband and I bought a so-called vacation home here, and I guess we're still on extended vacation because we moved here full-time about 10 years ago. And so it's been really interesting to get involved with the people here, learn their ways. You know, it's been interesting to me to see how different and, you know, little nuances, little ways that people can be so different regionally or state by state. And I've really enjoyed getting to know people here because I'm originally from Miami, and it's just, you know, it's a very different world. And it's been interesting to find my own little place here among these people, which isn't always easy, I don't think, when you move to another area, another region, another state, where it can be so culturally different, or where it can be just so different in the way people live, as opposed to, say, South Floridians live a very different kind of life than North Carolinians. Just the weather alone makes their lives quite different. It's been an interesting journey for me to move here and to comfortably fit here. I'm fortunate because I've been able to do that.
Yeah, for sure. Small town, rural areas, and the more isolated it is, the more true it is that you can live there 50 years and still be considered a newcomer, you know. So
That's right.
I suspect a lot of people still consider you a newcomer, but it sounds like they may have accepted you. You know, our main flagship station is WETS out of East Tennessee, Northeast Tennessee. And
right.
it's within the listening area of where you live. Where are you in the mountains of Western North Carolina?
I'm in little old Spruce Pine, beloved Spruce Pine, which is about an hour northeast of Asheville.
Mm-hmm.
And this place really influenced the setting for my first book, Beneath a Thousand Apple Trees.
Sure.
And that it's a big logging area. It's a big apple growing area. Just the place I live just really was instrumental in creating the setting for my book.
And you mentioned coming up here as a kid from Miami. I'm a Floridian, too, and we also came up from South Florida for vacations in the summer. So I think a lot of, particularly people over the age of 30 or 35 or so, a lot of people used to come up to the North Carolina mountains in the summer from South Florida. So even a lot of our Florida listeners will be relating to some of the locales you're talking about. You know, Janie, I was struck by the fact that your dialogue, even going back 70 or 80 years ago, sounds very realistic to me. And again, I spent, time up in the mountains, and I live now in a mountainous area of East Tennessee. So to me, none of the characters are made to sound hokey country or hillbilly-ish. You know, they're kind of the place where they live, of course, but they range in intelligence and strength of character in the normal way that people do. So how did you develop such a good ear in a fairly short time for the Carolina mountain people's way of talking? I mean, did you really kind of embed yourself with them a lot?
I listen. I think a key to being a good writer is to be a good listener. And I really listen to people's expressions up here, the way that they would phrase things. And at first it was a little hard to understand exactly what they might be talking about, but I've gotten very used to it. And I always just found it really interesting. I think much of it has its roots in the Scottish kind of dialect. And it's been interesting to listen to them and to just hear the way that they express themselves. And so I think just the fact that I'm naturally drawn to that I enjoy listening to that, helps in the dialogue writing.
I'm sure, too. I mean, you're a writer, and I can tell, you like to talk like a lot of writers do, and you're probably gregarious from the sound of it. And I think if you show an interest in people, too, as opposed to giving them the feeling that you look down on them, then that makes a big difference, too, in terms of their accepting you and being willing to talk to you. I suspect you do that pretty well. So with the first book, Beneath a Thousand Apple Trees, you mentioned orchards. I kept waiting for the apple trees to make an appearance in the book, and they do in the second half of the book, but you seem to know a lot about how an apple orchard is operated, and for that matter, you mentioned lumber mills, too. So an old-time lumber mill, which doesn't operate today the same way it used to back then, but yeah, you seem to know a lot about the way those are set up and operate. So how did you specifically learn those things about orchards and lumber mills?
I call those places. And, it's funny, Court, because when I was thinking about doing some women's fiction writing, the thing that really made me kind of hesitate from doing it, kept me from doing it for a good long while, was I dreaded all the research I'd have to do.
Hmm.
And, it's so funny. Some of the things that we end up dreading the most in life end up being the things that bring us much joy and that are most interesting. And that was the case with the research. I called Bill Carson over at the AltaPass Apple Orchard, and he was just gracious and kind and generous with his time. And I went over there and sat with him for hours and hours talking about growing apples, maintaining an orchard, the things that they fear the most, the things that they hope for the most. And it was more than just getting the information. I wanted to see his face. I wanted to pick up the emotions that he felt as he was talking about this thing that he did so well, and that was running this orchard. I just needed to feel the emotions from him. Same thing over at Parker Lumber Products, where I went over and spoke with Tim Parker, because my character in the book Beneath a Thousand Apple Trees gets injured at her father's sawmill. So I needed to talk to somebody in the know that could tell me realistically how that might happen. And see, if I may, that's the difference, a big difference between women's fiction and romance. It can get real gritty, women's fiction can. It's very true to life. It's not always happy, because life is not always happy. And so women's fiction follows more of the truisms of life, whereas, as you pointed out, and rightly so, the romance genre is more the swashbuckling, the pirate kidnaps the heroine, and they sail off into the sunset and have a happy, lovely ending. So I really wanted to pick up the emotions and truly find out how things work, how things could happen, so that when I wrote it in my novels, it was true, it was real. So I hope I was able to do that.
Well, it's funny, there was one thing that was real in your first book, Beneath a Thousand Apple Trees, that I had never heard of before, and even though I've spent some time up in the western North Carolina mountains, as I mentioned, and that's a concept of the warp buyer. So just briefly, Janie, give us kind of a very thumbnail description of what a warp buyer is or was.
And you're right, one of the key things in the book. The grandmother is a warp buyer, I will say that. And a friend of mine, she and I were actually going Christmas shopping, and she was talking about her mother-in-law, that she was a warp buyer. And I said, okay, stop right there. I wanted to hear all about what that was. And there really are warp buyers. I've actually met three people who have family members that have warp buyers in their family. The wart buyer is somebody that will get rid of your wart, and you have to kind of go through this little song and dance with that wart buyer. They will ask if they can buy your wart from you. You have to give them permission. They will rub it with a penny that they have. They usually keep a jar of pennies. They will rub it with a penny and then instruct you to never, ever lose or spend that penny. And if you do, the wart will come back. So the way I incorporated it into my novel was that as people were getting their warts removed, they would often tell the wart buyer secrets. And just as we do, like when we go to a salon to get our hair done or pedicure, we're sitting there telling people, these people working on us, what's going on in our lives. And I think many times we end up divulging little things that maybe if we looked back, we think maybe we shouldn't have said that. But that is a central part that the wart buyer in my book plays, is that she's kind of the local Dear Abby, if you will.
Yeah, and the wart buyer, I gather, the key to it is that that's a trustworthy person who's discreet and can be trusted to not divulge the secrets that you tell her, and I assume it's mostly her. So that's part of it, huh?
Oh, that's right. I mean, it has to be somebody that's well-respected and really admired and trusted, as you said it. It must be.
You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with author Janie DeVoe, who is a North Carolina novelist, a new novelist, and we're talking with her because she's got a couple of novels out and more on the way. The first one's called Beneath a Thousand Apple Trees, but let's talk about the second book, The Art of Breathing, and that's in large part about the struggle, as you mentioned, I think at one point earlier here, about the struggle of the main character with tuberculosis. And I guess that's where the breathing part comes in, I assume. So I won't be a spoiler and say whether she survived it, but it was always a harrowing experience having tuberculosis, and a high percentage of people did not survive it until the discovery of, I think it was streptomycin in the late 1940s. So many people don't realize what an epidemic tuberculosis once was. My gosh, the rates of death from tuberculosis in cities like New York and Washington, D.C. were, I looked this up, 4 or 5 per 1,000 people per year well into the 20th century. So your character, Catherine is her name in The Art of Breathing, contracted it when there were fairly effective treatments around, and many people did survive, and they went to special hospitals called sanatoriums. So what were sanatoriums like?
Well, you know, it was an interesting thing to research this. I really was really moved by what people went through that contracted it, and all through the time that it was not only running rampant, but then when it had started to slow down. The biggest thing, the thing that really struck me the most, was how isolated these people were in these sanatoriums. They did have family and friends come to visit, but oftentimes family and friends would be afraid to come and visit for fear that they too would contract this terrible disease.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right, Court. An amazing amount of people died from this disease before the introduction of streptomycin. More people died from tuberculosis than all of the wars put together. Over 2 billion people died from this disease,
wow.
With the numbers still rising. Not, of course, in any way that they did at one time when it was the terrible epidemic back in the late 1800s and into the very early 1940s, or at least late 30s. And that's when my grandmother had it. It was too bad because she passed away 6 years before streptomycin was introduced. And interesting thing was, majority of people that contracted this disease were between the ages of 15 and 45, I believe. So these were young people, and they were being taken away from their families, their friends, at the height of their lives, at that most precious time when you're, you know, trying to raise a family and build a career or whatever the case may be. And they were shuffled off to these sanatoriums. And it was the treatments were barbaric early on. And then as time went by, treatments became more humane. Like, for instance, they used to take out ribs to allow your diseased lung to have plenty of room to expand and contract as it breathed. And so it was almost like some of these treatments and so-called remedies were far more horrific than the disease itself. They would sandbag your chest. You'd be laying flat in bed. They would put sandbags on your chest to keep your breathing more limited in order to let your lungs rest some. And so that the treatments could about kill you more than the disease. But my grandmother died in 1938 in a sanatorium up in Chicago, the Chicago Municipal Tuberculosis Sanatorium. And it was one of the biggest, or the biggest, in the United States. And the buildings that made up that sanatorium are now part of a vast park system. And my husband and I went up there, and we were given a tour of these buildings, and we were able to go up to the attic of this park administration building, which used to be the morgue. And they still had records up there. And it was fascinating. It was very eerie in a way,
yeah.
To be walking in these halls and within these walls where my grandmother had been for the last year of her life.
That is something, yeah. So, I mean, there are no current working sanatoriums because tuberculosis is down to a couple cases a year, I think, or, you know, a few cases around the country. But so you visited a former mothballed sanatorium, let's call it, and were able to look at the records and so on. But how did you learn about the inner workings of sanatoriums? Because much of your second book, The Art of Breathing, is about what went on in specific detail within these, within those walls. How did you find that out? Just through reading and research, or what?
Yes, and also to visiting these places. I went over to a facility that used to be the Western Carolina Sanatorium. And it's now a mental health facility. And that sanatorium had been opened, I believe, in the 40s, Court, and ran through the 1970s. And so I got to see how the patients were treated far differently, with less barbaric kind of treatment. And it was important that I see that later kind of sanatorium, the more advanced kind of sanatorium, because that was really the era I was writing about with my character Catherine in The Art of Breathing. She's in the sanatorium in the early 50s. And what I found was that most people that were put into the sanatoriums at that time period had other things that had impacted their immune systems and made them less likely to respond well to, say, treatments at home. They really needed to be under the watchful care of a doctor 24 hours a day. For instance, my grandmother had scarlet fever. So that impacted her lungs and her heart. And my character in The Art of Breathing, Catherine, she too contracts scarlet fever. And so her immune system is weakened by it. And so these were the kind of people that were in the later sanatoriums. But it was interesting to me to see how they evolved over time. And one thing that was most amazing to me was that when tuberculosis was being treated and good results being seen from it and people going into remission, because you never actually get rid of tuberculosis. It can go into remission and you can live a perfectly normal life, but you never actually get rid of the disease. But what was really interesting to me was to see how these sanatoriums became sanitariums. And the reason that these sanatoriums became sanitariums was because the tuberculosis hospitals were no longer needed. They did not need to be dedicated hospitals for that disease. So in order for the state to keep funding the treatments of these patients, they combined different hospitals, and one that they did very quickly was they combined mental health facilities, or what they used to call state hospitals for the insane.
Right.
And they just kind of absorbed the sanatoriums. And so people that were of normal mental function but had tuberculosis were all of a sudden being institutionalized into these state mental hospitals. And such was the case with my character, which I must say made it very interesting to research and also gave me lots of great avenues to explore about her relationship with different characters in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was really an eye-opener to me to see how not only these poor people had the disease, but then they were all of a sudden sent to these mental institutions later on in the time frame where people were being treated institutionally for the disease. And so that was really a sad thing to learn, but a very interesting thing too.
I can imagine those must have been interesting places to work, to put it mildly, when those two very different but extreme kinds of situations were combined in one large building. You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Janie DeVoe, an author of two books, two recent novels that are taking place mostly in the western North Carolina mountains where she lives. Now, Janie, you, I know, began as an author of children's books, and I gather you had a string of pretty successful ones. So what made you decide at a certain point to transition totally over to adult fiction? They're obviously very, very different. Was it a hard transition to make? What prompted that?
It was a scary transition to make, and it seemed daunting to me, mainly because I knew that to write women's fiction would involve a lot of research, at least the kind of women's fiction that I wanted to write, because there are a lot of historical aspects to my novels. I had an agent at the time, a literary agent, and she had read some of my short stories. And she encouraged me to write women's fiction. And so I thought, well, you know, I might just go ahead and try it. And I started to do some research, and I found that I just loved it. And so that was the beginning of that change in genre. And I just jumped in with both feet and decided this was what I was going to do. So I stopped writing the children's books, at least I have at this point, because I just really enjoy following my character's development, women's journey, which is such an important and integral part of women's fiction, and just watching these characters grow. And as I'm sitting there writing it, it's almost like the story told to me. And so that's not to say I won't go back and do children's books at some point, but it's really been nice to make that change to this other genre. I think it's made my writing better, I would hope at least, more interesting, and it also opened up a chance for me to do a blog and really talk more about writing and life in general as I was constructing these fictitious females' journeys. It really just gave me a lot of fodder for being able to write on a blog and write about things that I think women are interested in and like reading about.
Well, I would imagine it's, the children's books you wrote, I looked at one, were for little children. I mean, they're little short sentences with little small words and they're cutesy things. And so to make that jump to writing, you know, really serious adult fiction for women is quite a leap. So I'm impressed, you know, with your versatility as a writer for doing that. Well, we just have a minute or so left, Janie, but I think that being an author these days is more entrepreneurial than it used to be. It's, you know, it used to be that you'd kind of, if you were lucky enough to get picked up by a publisher, they pretty much did everything and you were just along for the ride and might go out and do book signing tours and some PR stuff like that, but mainly sat back and collected royalties if you were lucky enough to sell some books. But today, you have to be more integrally involved, I think, in the business as a partner with the publisher, is my impression from a lot of the authors we've had on the show. So what do you do? You mentioned your blog. Besides writing the books themselves to move your writing career forward?
It is so much about the marketing. And these days, you know, with our cyber express that we have with computers and websites and all of the many different resources, it is just integral that you become this social media guru. And if you're not, which I am not, and I don't have time to learn to be, then you get the right people involved in helping you market through social media. And it has changed a lot, Court, because when I first started children's books, I mean, yes, of course, you know, it wasn't the age of the dinosaur. I started in 1999. But social media was vastly different than it is today. And the way I reached people was going to schools, going to libraries, giving speeches and presentations at various venues. And so I was out and about more. Now the author is more behind the scenes and doing things through the internet. And so, you know, it's funny because it's a blessing and a curse, social media. You can really get so tied up with it that you forget what it is you're supposed to be doing, and that's writing. But at the same time, it's a great way of reaching a whole lot of people.
Janie, we are going to have to leave it there then. That's great. I'm glad you're able to do it as successfully as you are. So again, the books are Beneath 1,000 Apple Trees and The Art of Breathing. They were published in August of 2016 and February 2017. You can buy them at the publisher's website, which is kensingtonbooks.com, kensingtonbooks.com, as an ebook, or as a paperback or ebook at Amazon or Barnes & Noble, or on Janie's website, Janie DeVoe's website, and it's spelled JanieDeVoe.com, JanieDeVoe.com. You can buy her books there, including the children's books that we've mentioned. She also has a Facebook page. You can look her up that way. Well, Janie, I want to thank you so much for being on with us on American Variety. It's been interesting.
Thank you, Court, and I really appreciate you having me on. I've enjoyed it.
That's great. Me too. And thanks to all of you out there for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.